Okay, so the title of today's sermon is A Little Amnesia, if you please. But I want to start out by being very, very clear that I am not advocating amnesia or memory wiping or Alzheimer's or forgetting our keys or any of that. I have enough of that. I would not go so far as to say that I have amnesia. And I also don't want to imply it's a laughing matter. In fact, I've forgotten so many things that I have to ask my husband to serve as kind of, I kind of think of him like as my external hard drive. Anybody do that with your spouse? A typical conversation in our home might be something like this. Me. Hey, Michael, I was just reading about blah, 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 and we should watch this movie sometime. Michael, we already have. No, we haven't. I've never even heard of it. Yes, you have. We watched it in 2003. It was right after your dad's surgery, and then we went to visit him in the hospital. Oh. Did I like it? So amnesia is not my challenge. Remembering is. Or is it? What I want to talk about today is how the struggle to remember things in times and places can sometimes be a misguided struggle, or maybe a misguided struggle. We have to do it in a wise way, a way that forwards the world, creates more love, not less. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it, goes the oft-quoted saying of George Santayana, the early 20th century philosopher. This quote, or some variant of it, is often used as the rationale that we give to our children who do not want to do their history homework. Everybody done that? I will say that another of his quotes goes, "The human race, in its intellectual life, is organized like the bees. The masculine soul is the worker, and essentially dedicated to impersonal and universal arts. The feminine is a queen, infinitely fertile, but passive and abounding in intuitions without method and passions without justice." Well, if it wasn't such a good quote about history, I think that right there would knock out George Santayana for me. But there is something fundamentally true. We believe in the value of history, of knowing what came before. The good life for both the individual and the larger humanity is contingent on learning, we believe, from studying the past with deliberation and intensity, trying to avoid the mistakes that our ancestors made. Santayana, who died in the early 1950s, lived in a time much different than our own. Ironically, even as the past slips away, the past is perhaps more present to us now than it was in Santayana's day. We know that technology is hurtling us ever faster into a future, or present even, of instant communication, international trade, smart houses and talking refrigerators, and exploration of the outer planets, materials, and wonders the world has never seen. And our big data allows us to, in some way, remember and assemble it like never before. While those external hard drive spouses may have always been around in one way or another, now we have the digital capability to study the data from the past, whole armies of university researchers to analyze and study it with their algorithms. This big data keeps growing at an ever faster pace, matched only by an ever increasing ability to access the information, the speed of light, and 24/7. And thanks to drones, cameras, satellites, and the ubiquitous cell phone camera, within a generation or two, I wonder how many minutes of our lives will there actually be that go unrecorded and do not sit somewhere on some electronic archive. We can also learn about the past in ways that weren't dreamed about a generation ago. For example, I know a woman who recently had her DNA sampled. She was able to learn the percentage ethnic composition of her ancestors. Although I don't quite know the details, she learned a lot of her genetic history and that it included some Serbo-Croatians and some people from southern Africa. This technological searching, trying to understand ourselves, can sometimes have humorous effects. Men, I don't see any of you wearing a kilt today, but you know what I'm talking about. And then there are those of you that want to prepare that, what is it, haggis stew, because you discovered that there was a Scotch ancestor among you. The huge information bonanza that we are living also applies to the distant past. While there were no cell phones to capture the first days of Europeans in the New World, for example, researchers now have a better chance of assembling and analyzing the data that do exist. I recently learned that there is an archaeological site over 500 years old near Morganton, and they're now using radar to penetrate the ground to find where the holes from the Spanish encampment, their posts were. This ground-penetrating radar has allowed archaeologists to make a map of the area near Stonehenge. Using 21st-century techniques, the Stonehenge Hidden Landscapes Project team has transformed our knowledge of the ancient, special landscape. Their work has revealed a clutch of previously unsuspected sites and monuments showing how much of this story of this world-famous archaeological treasure remains to be told, reported the BBC last year. But even as we piece together more and more history, we understand more and more about the human violent past. A couple of weeks ago, it was Columbus Day. We all know how much that holiday has changed since we were children. Some states do not celebrate it as a holiday at all. And there is a growing movement to now celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day, reflecting a more even-handed treatment of the effects of Columbus's voyage to the New World, particularly drawing attention to the ensuing violence, atrocities, genocide by disease, and enslavement that followed for all the lands of the New World in the wake of the Columbian expeditions. And this is just one example of a newfound understanding of a history of human violence. Perhaps, though, it is not only our technology, but an increasing democratization that allows for these stories to be told and spread. The voices of the margins, of minorities, have become strong enough to have them written into the history books, I mean files, as well. And this is good. I believe this is good. But what I'm grappling with, what prompts this sermon, is that I have a gnawing fear that our societal, no doubt admirable, pursuit of what really happened down to the last detail could lead not to more justice, but less. Because what do we do with what we learn? What do we do with the skeletons in the closet? Surely, once discovered, they can't go back into the closet, at least not to stay. But what should we do with all this information? My worry is that it is possible to use the violence of the past as an excuse for more in the future. How can we know about it in a way that we learn to make it less likely? Now, at one level, we can't get away from the past, of course, because, and mark this well, in every single detail up to this present moment, both joyful and horrific, every single detail of the past has brought us, you and me, right here to this present moment. I'll say more about that in a minute. So, of course, we can't deny the history of the past. We can't get away from it. But to learn from history means not only to try to know what happened, but to understand how humans react to what happened, to avoid letting past tragedy be the seeds for the future. 5 years ago, the New York Times op-ed writer Roger Cohen wrote a piece called The Living and the Dead, in which he called this hazard the abuse of memory. In that essay, he identified how human cultures use victimization stories as powerful agents of national identity. From there, one moves on to a place of justification. In Yugoslavia, he writes, it was the weapon of choice for nationalist leaders bent on stirring violence. It proved very potent, to the tune of more than 100,000 dead. He goes on to say that during his time in the Balkans, he learned two things. The first was how blinding victimhood can be. The historical victim, Serb in this case, cannot even see when he becomes the chief perpetrator of violence. The second was that nothing forges national identity, Bosnian Muslim in this case, faster than persecution. More recently, Mr. Cohen has written of the plight of Syrian refugees now pouring into Europe and all too often getting the cold shoulder. What will these people remember if and when they survive? Will they remember the volunteers like Charlotte's niece? Or will they remember the governments who turned them away? Will memories of desperation and indifference to their plight help to create their story of victimization powerful enough to radicalize their sons and daughters and distant generations? Because I think if the past has been bad enough, and if you study it enough and are horrified enough, then you can justify almost anything with it. The scary thing about this is the past does not need to be your own past. It could be your father's, your mother's, your great-grandparents. It could just be your people, however you define that, whether it be by political party or geographic region, or skin color, national origin, gender, social class. We have so many ways of subdividing ourselves and telling the stories of our group. Going back to my contention, it isn't that the stories don't hold some truth, but it is in what service do we let the stories operate? I think this is of particular interest for us as Unitarian Universalists, because what it brings to my mind, at least, is this whole idea of original sin, which we rejected so long ago. And if we do not accept the contention of original sin, surely we should not accept the contention that the sins of our fathers and mothers, the horrors of our fathers and mothers, grandparents, great-grandparents, et cetera, should be vindicated today. The Israeli master poet, Yehuda Amichai wrote that Jerusalem was, quote, the only city in the world where the right to vote is granted even to the dead. And in fact, it is this line that inspired this sermon in the first place. Jerusalem is the only city in the world where the right to vote is granted even to the dead, he wrote. Now, I doubt that, in fact, Jerusalem is the only city in the world where that is the case. But I do think it is true that too many human beings would rather fight on behalf of the dead and the injustices that they can no longer feel, then work on behalf of the living and the future. One reality about the past that I'm pretty sure of is that if you look long enough and hard enough, you will find that every single one of us, somewhere along the way in our ancestral past, and probably not too far back, maybe in your own memory, you will find that every single one of us is the product of horrific violence, war, rape, oppression, enslavement. This is not to say that our brothers and sisters in this world who suffer this very day while we sit here in relative privilege and comfort are not worthy of particular attention. Quite the opposite. This should inspire us to work for their justice, not just for those alive today, but for their descendants, so that when their history is written, the temptation to vindicate the past will be less. What I hope that we can do in this age of information, and what I hope that we can do personally as we look at our own stories, is to make sure that we own our history and accept it, but do not let it own us and drive us. Our past is, of course, a part of who we all are, but it doesn't have to dictate the choices that we make in the present. We get to honor the past, but create the future based on a vision of what could be, not what was. In another poem, not the one about the dead in Jerusalem, Yehuda Amichai writes, "Visits of condolence is all we get from them. They squat at the Holocaust Memorial. They put on grave faces at the Wailing Wall. They laugh behind heavy curtains in their hotels. And they have their pictures taken together with our famous dead at Rachel's tomb and Herzai's tomb and on Ammunition Hill. They weep over our sweet boys and lust after our tough girls and hang up their underwear to dry quickly in cool blue bathrooms. But once I sat on the steps by Agate at David's Tower. I placed my two heavy baskets at my side. A group of tourists was standing around their guide, and I became the target marker. You see that man with the baskets? Yeah, just right of his head and over a little bit. Well, there's a Roman arch. Yep, an arch from the Roman period. Just right of his head. But he's moving, he's moving. I said to myself, redemption will come only if their guide tells them. You see that arch from the Roman period? It's not important, but next to it, left and down a bit, there sits a man who has bought fruit and vegetables for his family."